Franco is pretty smart, but Franco is a child. And when it comes to the day of the contest, I'm his father. He comes to me for advices. So it's not that hard for me to give him the wrong advices.
Hey guys, what's up? Welcome to Advices Radio. You are listening to Huge As Fuck, Volume 2, and today we are speaking with Dave Crossland. I'm your host, Scott McNally. If you remember back to Episode 3 of Advices, we had Dave on the show. At the time, we spoke about Under Construction 2, the film which he was in that had just been released. Under Construction 1 and 2, he was the main subject for these movies, documentaries that were by James Grelish, filmmaker. We've also spoken to James about these movies, so definitely check that out. Today, our main focus is getting big, getting huge, if you will, getting huge as fuck. And Dave has had some serious experience with this. His goal in the film Under Construction 2 was to break the 400-pound mark. Spoiler alert, it happened. He got to 415 in the movie. We talk about growing muscle here, and we talk about the ramifications, too. It's not just an all pretty, beautiful, fun thing. Being big is not easy, and Dave is going to talk to us about that today. Dave is a performance and image-enhancing drug specialist. He has worked with the military, as well as a bunch of different organizations and people. He is a diet and a training coach, and today he is going to share with us his insights. So let's dive right in. We're going to go straight into the middle of the conversation to pick up with Dave Crossland. And guys, one more note, if you would like to help support the network, go to advicesradio.com/shop, and you can buy yourself a t-shirt there. Thank you for everybody who has already been supporting the network. I much appreciate it. You guys are keeping podcasting happening here at Advices Radio. I appreciate each and every one of you. So thank you guys, and let's get right into this conversation. I figured today what I wanted to center things around is this new sub-project that I have going on. You know, I have my program, Advices Radio, and we cover all sorts of things, and, you know, a lot of health stuff, and a lot of different things that go in different directions. And I wanted to focus on hardcore bodybuilding and what's the foundation of that, but is first, you know, being able to grow the muscle, put on the size. So I'm calling this segment Huge As Fuck because, I mean, realistically, at the end of the day, if you don't have the muscle, you can get as conditioned as you want, as shredded as you want, but you really didn't achieve much in bodybuilding, you know? So I figure talking to a guy like you, you have pushed it to really the outside max, you know, of this. And it might not have necessarily been a pretty 400 plus pounds, but you figured out how to push your body to the absolute max.
Well, yeah, I mean, the 365, 370, I would say, was reasonably presentable. The 415 was a mess.
How long was that period that it took you to get to 415?
I went from 300 to 365 in 7 months.
Wow, man, that's crazy.
And I actually wasn't in as bad condition as people sort of tried to make out I was, to be fair. When I dropped the water, when I came off, I was sitting at 355. You could see where the abs were supposed to be.
Yeah. Nice.
Then the 415 was about 14 months, but that whole project was a disaster from start to finish with one problem after another, injuries, downtime. So there was never really a clear period of production.
Okay.
It was never productive. I was plagued with a lot of issues that I didn't understand at the time. And basically they were all revolving around my kidneys, started to struggle. But I was so water retentive that it was and so densely water retention, it was more appearing like body fat.
Okay. Yeah.
I couldn't understand why I was gaining so much body fat.
Yeah.
So I started reducing calories and stuff like that. And obviously in the net end of it was the bulk of the growth, so to speak, through that period was actually just super compensation of glycogen through insulin and growth use. It wasn't really actually muscle mass.
Okay.
So, but that was not down to the plan, as in what I planned to do. It was down to the execution because of this shit, I'm getting fat, sort of knee-jerk reaction, which what I really should have done was investigate properly, and I would have known then. But then I did seek medical advice, and they screwed up as well. So much so, actually, that there's a lawsuit at the moment.
Really? Really?
Well, I wasn't going to bother. I wanted to make the doctor that fucking kept telling me that my kidneys were fine when they weren't answerable to fucking up. That was all I wanted to do. Basically, I wanted him to be made accountable. I wasn't interested in finances.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was actually the renal specialist that suggested I make him accountable for what had gone on.
Huh.
And so when I got legal involved, they started looking at things, and it's just become a bigger thing than I ever expected it to be now. So there's actually a total of 6 doctors currently under investigation, because all 6 had seen me over a 2-3 year period, and not one of them had suggested that I may be in renal failure. But when the specialist saw me, he said I'd been in renal failure for 4 years plus.
Wow. Can you tell us what causes this? What causes kidney problems with bodybuilding? Because it's something that we see a lot, and of course we always tell people you know you got to get your lab work done, and you got to track this stuff. But what would have been the stressor that made this happen?
It turns out that my kidney function has been compromised for quite a long period of time, i.e. over a decade.
Okay.
Now, when you think that really since the age of 16, apart from a very brief period at 19, I've not been less than sort of 250, 300 pounds. And for the mass majority of that time, I've been over 300 pounds. In fact, because I trained until I was 24, 25.
Okay.
Then I had a very big break of about 12 years. In fact, probably nearer 15 years.
Wow. I didn't know that.
And in that time, I became morbidly obese, and I was close to 400 pounds of just fat.
Okay.
And the general consensus is that it was just the biggest contributing factor was my sheer bulk.
Okay.
But obviously the drug consumption has definitely not helped.
Sure.
Now, currently our understanding on the chemical interaction with the kidney is that there is none, but animal models have shown that particularly with trenbolone, there can be direct action with the kidneys. Mainly kidney damage comes from unregulated blood pressure. But I've never had an issue with blood pressure. The strange thing was, even at my biggest, my blood pressure was actually quite good.
No kidding.
And I only always sit somewhere around 125 over 67, 65, 60, those sort of numbers.
Wow. So in that sense, you're a genetic anomaly, really.
But at the same time, when I train, my blood pressure spikes massively.
Okay. Okay.
And so there seems to be a very wide range with my blood pressure, but like resting, testing has always come back. I remember having to go to hospital, and I was picked up by the ambulance. I'd basically burst a lot of blood vessels in my brain, and I thought I had a brain aneurysm because I was training.
Wow.
And I remember being picked up, and I was 380, 375 at the time, and I had 124 over 57.
Okay.
And the paramedics that picked me up took the blood pressure and just looked at me in absolute disbelief. And then they kept redoing it, because like, this can't be right. How the hell can your blood pressure be like that?
Right.
It's something I've never had a major issue with as such. But I mean, animal studies, particularly in rats, have shown that trenbolone has a direct action on the kidneys. There's actually probably a half a dozen case studies of acute kidney injury. Now, that isn't kidney failure. That's completely different.
Okay.
In bodybuilders using trenbolone. And I know personally of over half a dozen bodybuilders that have kidney function issues.
Yeah. Oh, so, yeah. It's so common.
I do think that there is a chemical link. I just think we're yet to find it or confirm exactly what it is.
Interesting. So you had said...
The big problem we have as well is because we supplement with creatine, we have high-protein diets,
Yeah. We
carry more muscle mass, we have high levels of creatinine in our bloodstream. So the whole EGFR system doesn't work properly for us.
Right.
And the result quite often is that we will see elevated readings, but we will dismiss them.
Yeah.
Because it's because you're creating knowledge because of that. So we don't investigate them. And I think even if it's always worth just, you know, that second look, quite often a very easy, simple way is just to test protein in the urine, which those sticks are absolutely pence. But if your kidneys are ruptured, if the glomeruli within the kidneys are damaged and they are not filtrating properly, then they will leak protein. And the funny thing is, for years before I was diagnosed, I've got a lot of muscle tears, somewhere in the region of about 20.
Okay.
And they're predominantly not from max effort heavyweight workouts. Predominantly have come 6, 7, 8, 9 reps into a set. Just I've been pushing hard. I mean, it has been sets that are at failure point or close to failure point, but I was fully warm and all this sort of stuff. And I remember having a conversation with a very, very high-end physio several years ago when he was looking at my pec detachment, and he said, you know, in his opinion, he felt that some people just genetically pre-positioned to him, but he also felt that muscular hydration was a big factor in pec tears.
That makes sense.
And he said, you always feel a little bit flat when I work on you. And I'd always felt that I never really felt full.
Okay.
And I always seemed to have an issue with sub-Q water, and I never really got the water to go intramuscular. And it turns out that with FSGS, which is what I've got, which is basically the little glomeruli filtration in the kidneys that damage the leak protein, I have low levels of blood albumin.
Okay.
Because I leak so much protein, which results in the fact that albumin binds with water in the blood and holds water in the blood.
No kidding. I see where you're going with this.
Glycogen and salts and electrolytes then pull that into the muscle. Well, I don't hold it in the blood, so it goes sub-Q because it's just the easiest, most natural way for it to go.
Yeah.
It doesn't help that I'm not the leanest as well, so that adds to that driving factor.
Sure.
So this is why I've always had this long-term issue with what I felt at the time was fullness and why I've always been prone to muscle tears. So my kidney function issues have been around for a very long time. But basically, I just got to the point where I was too big for what function I had to cope. And they started to struggle. And then as a result of that, they got more damaged because they were obviously being overworked. So the weight was the straw that broke the camel's back eventually.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, I remember once, and this is no word of a lie. In fact, it's in the second film because I go and see a health specialist. And I have a load of blood work done and a load of testing done. And the one thing she says to me is, you're dehydrated. I said, well, I'm drinking plenty of fluid. No, you need to up your salts and electrolytes. And she gave me a list of what I needed to get in there.
Yeah.
And she said, look, what I want you to do is megadose-ish for the first week.
Okay.
And I did. And that huge influx of salts and minerals and electrolyte did shift the water massively in the muscle. And the result was I put over an inch on my arms. And I woke up the next morning and we were filming Minch, so James was up at the house, and I woke up like a day and a half later, and then I went downstairs, and he just went, "What the hell's happened to you?" He says, "You look absolutely huge."
Yeah.
And that point was when my arms hit 26 and a half inch.
Okay.
But it was all, and the water manipulation within the muscle, I mean, I know a lot of people mess around with the stage, but it's what a lot of, it's why you see a lot of pros off season and they look insanely huge.
Huh.
But you don't see it carry off into stage. And that's because off season they've got growth, they've got insulin there, they've got super compensation of glycogen within the muscle.
Yeah.
And they literally swell, but it isn't something that can be maintained.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, even Rich Piana used to manipulate this. And I remember, I didn't want much of Richard's stuff, but I do remember catching part of a video one day and he was talking about an insulin and growth protocol he ran before Expos.
I remember that. I remember that.
He was saying about it putting 20, 30 pounds on him. And that's what it was. It was the super compensation of glycogen in the muscle. I mean, Rich was paranoid about the way he looked and ever being considered to be small. So pretty much every big Expo he ever did, he used to run this protocol, so he came in looking a lot bigger.
Yeah.
But that's never sort of his baseline, if you know what I mean.
Sure. No, I'm feeling that myself right now. I had gotten hurt for a minute and it got me depressed. I wasn't eating as much. And once that happens, I start flattening out. I start looking small. And once I began training again, I started pushing, you know, a little bit of insulin pre-workout, and you know, I'm on the growth. Between pushing the insulin though and getting the blood back into the muscle, I look like a different person a week later. You know, it's not muscle, that's for sure, but everything's rounder now, everything's fuller. I would like to think that that will lead to muscle gain, keeping it full like that. Would you agree?
From what I've seen, I think that the net gain is actually quite minimal.
Yeah.
Particularly when you start looking at the stresses it puts on the body. I mean, you're talking for a super heavy, you're talking potentially 20, 30 extra pounds you're carrying around that isn't muscle. Bear in mind, super heavies are that big that generally they're not in their healthiest state anyway.
Okay.
And if anyone's ever met one of the big guys off season, they will be well aware of how much they struggle to move around and how bad their breathing is, and in general, how unfit they actually look.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to mention names, but I know a couple of high-end mass monsters that literally need 5 to 10 minutes post their working set to recover.
Wow.
And so, I mean, I do know someone that ran a very heavy insulin and growth protocol, and they were enormous, okay. Particularly when you took into account their height. And actually, at the size they were, the condition was really good. And yet, when they stepped on stage later that year, they were nigh on 70 pounds lighter.
Wow.
But they weren't 70 pounds of condition better. They were only about 25, 30 pounds of condition better.
Okay.
So I'm not sure is the honest answer. I remember speaking to Andy Bolton, the powerlifter, years ago. We were having a conversation and we were talking about all sorts of things. And we were talking about drug doses and this, that, and the other. And the one thing he turned around and said to me was, yeah, but there becomes a point where you start to not feel very good. And he says, what's the point of taking all this shit if you don't feel well enough to give it 110% in the gym?
I think that's a great point. Jordan Peters makes a similar point.
Yeah, but then I do think Jordan Peters is probably one of the people that's suffering.
Yes, I agree. I agree. He's pushed it up pretty high, and I know that he gets to uncomfortable points. I see what you're saying.
I recognize in Jordan what I experienced myself. Now, Jordan carried insane amount of muscle mass.
Yeah.
And the guy's incredibly strong. I mean, if he turned to powerlifting, he'd probably destroy a lot of the powerlifting records.
I bet.
Very, very quickly. But I've noticed what I used to suffer with in Jordan. You know, and Jordan's a little bit like me, apart from he has the ability to have condition as well, but he's constantly chasing the mass.
Yeah, he is.
You're fucking big enough. You don't need it, you know. And I mean, Jordan's only 27, 28?
Yeah, late 20s, 28 maybe.
You know, and he's starting to look as old as me, and I'm now on fucking 50. Well, very clever guy, ultimate respect, good friend as well, though we don't really speak as much as we should just because of work life being as it is.
Sure.
But I wonder at what cost sometimes.
So here's what I'm trying to weed out in my head. You're talking about taking this super compensation to extremes. What if to that point? What if you're uncomfortable? I feel like what if you can take it though less? Take it just to the point where you're feeling rounder, you're feeling fuller.
Well, I mean,
you're able to train hard, get good pumps, and not deal with the sleep apnea and stuff.
I don't know, but then we live in a world where we exist in an environment where you know excess is nothing exceeds like excess at the end of the day.
Yeah, if you can, if I can get away with this, I should probably do 5 more units.
if 2 mil's good, then friggin' hell, 4's going to be amazing.
Yeah.
Same with pre-workouts, you know. It's we have a society of that now. When you look at the cost of high-quality growth hormone, and you look at the potential risks, particularly with insulin resistance coming off the back of this stuff. I don't genuinely think it's worth it. Now, when you go back to mentioning Jordan, it's quite good you mentioned that because when he was with Milos, he was using, I think it was in excess of 100 IU of Splint a day.
Yeah, a lot, I'm sure.
He said that comp prep post that bulk with Milos was the hardest he'd ever done. And my thoughts on it were because he was insulin resistant and it didn't matter what drugs he was running, they weren't compensating for that problem. And ultimately you cannot, well, yes, but you can, but most people won't run right into a show on insulin. And that's why he found the diet so extremely hard. I'm a great believer in that you need to manage your own, don't like insulin particularly, and I've used it, and I've used it high doses, low doses, fast acting, low acting. In fact, I crashed a car on insulin because I went fucking hyper.
Oh, wow.
That's about 85 mile an hour.
Oh, God.
Yeah. It wasn't a good experience. There wasn't much left of the car either. the thing is, I honestly feel now that I'm better and I would get better results by just managing my own insulin sensitivity.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what we all generally, for the vast majority of us, we run on carb-based diets.
Okay.
Now, okay, comp time, we might choose a keto approach, but whatever we do, generally comp time is low carb, yeah?
I'd agree, sure.
What happens post-competition?
We dump the carbs back in.
And what happens to us?
Well, we first gain a lot of water, then we get fat, and we lose our conditioning.
Yeah, but initially,
we fill back up,
we look awesome. And we're strong and the power's coming on. We hold condition quite well.
Okay, yeah.
And yes, it's a rebound, but part of the mechanism for rebound is because we are so insulin sensitive, so we are shuttling nutrition so effectively into our muscles.
I see.
Now, when you manage your insulin throughout your bulk, so you run products like, I wouldn't go for metformin, but I would look at products like berberine.
Okay.
What I find, and I find it with my clients, is that you get a lot better response to diet changes.
Interesting.
And I think what a lot of people mess up is they'll diet for a show or on whatever, 1,500, 2,000, 2,500, whatever your calories is, it doesn't really matter in this conversation.
Right.
And then they'll go, right, off season, I'm going to pull. And they'll stick another 2,000 calories into their diet.
Instantly, you're saying like out the gate, they just dump them. They want to get big, so they add that extra 2,000. Sure, I've seen it.
you'll get a quick response very quickly, but you'll soon blunt your own insulin sensitivity. Mm. And all of a sudden the tables turn. And where you've been going weeks with a raging appetite, eating tons of food, feeling great, strong, full, still good condition, within a week you're fat.
Yeah.
That's how it appears. And to me, you get to that point where it's just like, whoa, no, insulin sensitivity is going down the toilet. I'm just going to store everything as fat now because I'm insulin resistant.
Right.
What I found with it is if I run people on berberine and we do very small increases, 100 calories here, 100 calories there, 200 calories there, but within 6 weeks, we're up to that 2,000 calorie jump we were aiming for.
Yeah.
But our appetites are still raging. We're still in reasonable condition and we're still growing really well. Because we don't crash our system, we don't overload it. And the two things that I think are for most people massively neglected in off season, well, maybe more than two, but one is training.
Okay.
And the second is diet and the management of the diet, because it's off season. I'm eating burgers and chips.
Mm.
Shit in equals shit out. It's as simple as that.
Sure.
Yeah, okay, you want to be a little bit more relaxed in off-season, but you still need to get good quality nutrition. I'm not a believer in if it fits your macros, and I've yet to see anyone of 300-pound-plus muscle that runs that style of diet.
I agree.
If you're naturally fast metabolism, it can work very well for you. It's more of a relaxed atmosphere. But if you're serious about putting size on, then you've got to be serious about what you put in your body.
You know, I have a very fast metabolism, and even if I start relying on junk food to meet my macros and to keep my calories higher, it affects my appetite. It affects my digestion. If I keep things cleaner and I may still throw some dirtier foods in, I feel like that just, it works. My body functions better. So I don't think at least for me, there's no excuse for me to eat junk all the time just to grow.
I think one of the biggest contributing factors to the rapidness of my first bulk, where I went from 300 to 365, was the fact that my diet was comp clean.
Really?
Oh, people thought I ate shit. No.
So you gained 65 pounds eating clean foods, is what you're telling me. Wow.
Breakfast was porridge oats, protein powder, a few eggs. And then I'd go through, the rest of the meals were either rice or potato based. I'm very bad for veg, so I didn't have a lot of greens, unfortunately. And then every day I'd go through 3 kilos of meat, either chicken or beef, slow cooked overnight, fat skimmed off the top.
Okay.
And the other thing was my cholesterol was really good as well.
Hmm. Interesting.
And bear in mind, I hit 4.5 grams of gear on that first big bulk.
Do you feel that as far as meat sources or as far as protein sources go, that beef has something special to it, that beef is better than, say, you know, chicken or fish or turkey for growing?
I think beef, I think there's a couple of things with beef. I think it's a more effective thermogenic protein source. You know, we burn more energy digesting beef, so therefore we can put more calories in.
Okay.
If your maintenance is 3,000 calories, but you eat foods that cause a lot of energy expenditure to digest, then your maintenance goes up to 3,500 calories.
Hmm. Okay.
But you've got that extra 500 calories worth of nutrition in your system.
I see.
So you've got extra grams of protein, you've got extra grams of micronutrients and everything else in your system, but you've got no excess calorie in your system. And this is one of the key features around recombing. You eat foods that require a lot of energy to digest that are clean, and therefore you can actually be in calorie deficit when it comes to your overall body mass, but you're in nutritional excess when it comes to your muscular body mass.
Hmm.
But yeah, I mean, I think you need to vary your protein sources, because obviously apart from egg, you want to be looking at a full amino profile as best you can.
Okay.
I'm not a big fan on amino acid supplementation from the point of view of like intradrinks and stuff like that, but I do think they're useful if you've got limited access to your protein sources. So if predominantly you rely on chicken or you rely on beef, for whatever reason it may be, it might be economics, availability, it might just be taste, then it would be a good idea to run some essential amino acids with those meals to make sure you've got the full amino acid profile there.
Interesting. So you'll use amino acids with these solid meals, is what you're saying.
Yeah, if I mean, ideally, what you want in a meal is, you know, a bit of beef, bit of chicken, bit of fish, and then you'll have a fully amino acid profile there.
Okay, Dave Kalik, I just spoke to him last week for Advices Radio, Huge AF. He said the same thing. He loves mixing his protein sources in the same meal.
The other thing with that as well, and I got problems with this. I mean, I literally ate the same food every day for months. And one of the reasons why it was, and it was just very plainly, literally the condiments would be soy sauce, salt, pepper, and that would be about it.
Just day in, day out, huh?
Day in, day out. And I literally went through 8 kilos of food a day.
Wow.
That was the weight of the food I was consuming.
Wow.
And it was just short of 10,000 calories. It was all clean, and there was very little in the way of drinks. Drink-wise, it was only about 1,000 calories came from drinks.
Okay.
But what I did find was I actually got to the point at one stage where I literally could not stomach chicken, the touch, the texture, the taste. And what I found is if I vary my protein sources, I don't build up this almost like a rejection process that happens. I just have to leave it out for a while, and then I could bring it back in, and it wasn't so bad. Or even if I brought it back in with different textures mixed in with it.
Yeah.
So I'd get chicken, I'd mash it, almost shred it, and then I'd crumble rice cakes into it.
Yeah, really? You know, and you're a bodybuilder when you do something like that.
That change in texture made it palatable. Otherwise, as soon as it hit my mouth, I was retching.
Interesting.
But yeah, I mean, the force feeding at that point, and most people, for what they're trying to gain size-wise, would never require force feeding. But when you're starting to go into those sort of areas of size,
yeah,
you've got no choice.
Now, when you say force feeding, can you define that for me? Because I think that some people haven't experienced what force feeding is.
Yeah, obviously it's slightly different to everybody, but I suppose, I mean, with my, the force feeding that I experienced was, I was never hungry. In fact, I never desired a cheat. What I desired was not to eat. So on the rare occasions I allowed myself some leeway, basically I'd missed 2 meals.
Okay.
That's all I wanted to do. Our first meal would go down fine on its own. Second meal, yes, usually. Third, I was starting to become a bit of a chore.
Yeah.
So I'm no longer hungry, and I'm just basically shoveling it in.
Okay. So just like chew, swallow, chew, take a drink of water, swallow, repeat.
Well, yeah. Then as we get into 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8,
poof.
The chewing stops.
Wow.
And it goes in, and it's swilled down with water.
Yeah.
And as the day goes on, the later meals become entirely that.
Did you find that affected your digestion at all?
Not too much, but over time, yes, a little bit.
Yeah, okay.
But and that was, so it'd be like meal 4, I might need to do it for the last few mouthfuls, you know, and then meal 5, it might be a third of the meal was done that way. But meal 8, it was pretty much all that. And you literally sat there, and my waist would grow 3-4 inches in the day, and then the next morning it'd be back down, and we'd start the process all over again.
Okay.
And if I didn't get the meals in because I just couldn't face it anymore, then I obviously, when you're drinking the amount I was drinking at that point, everything else you're doing, you're going for the loo a couple of times a night. I think it's common with all of us that we end up basically pissing like racehorses.
True.
So what would happen is I'd go for a piss, and I'd end up sitting down on the loo for a pee, and with the food tub that I hadn't finished off from earlier on the day on my knee, and just shoveling it in.
Wow.
And I could have gone to drinks, but I've never yet found a protein powder that doesn't make me feel bloated.
Okay. Now let me ask you this, cause that's where I was going to go there soon. So you work with other people now. So you've seen, it sounds like protein powder hasn't worked for you. What about for people in general, somebody who does digest it well, is there going to be a benefit to using protein powder instead of food, or is solid food going to be better overall? Basically, I guess what I'm asking is that can we get around this force feeding by using some type of a protein supplement?
I would say that solid food will always be your first choice, but it's not always practical. It's not always realistic. And when you start getting to the mega calories, then yeah, I've got clients that drink some calories in.
Okay.
I tend to try and get them to use solid foods blended.
Okay. Interesting.
But what I will do, and it's so some of that's to do with the digestive process. You see, I want as much calorific burn in my digestive process for my clients as I want, because then I can put more food into them.
Sure.
Give them this excess of nutrient and not have too much of an excess in calories. Now, the two things that were problematic with predominantly liquid diets, and I've seen this in a few people, is an increase in stomach acid, because the food triggers the release of stomach acid, but because it's liquid and because it's easily digested, the stomach acid has got nothing to work on. So you get a buildup of stomach acid.
Hmm.
And I worked with a couple of guys that were offshore engineers. And as a result, they were allowed 3 meals a day. So they supplemented with drinks. So literally they had 3 solid and 3 liquid meals a day.
Okay.
And what they suffered from, and this was prior to me working with them, because we then changed the context of the drinks. But so what they suffered from was massive acid reflux. And as a result, both of them had really bad teeth.
Hmm.
Because the stomach acid was coming up and it was literally rotting the teeth.
Interesting.
Now, I don't mind protein powder. And, you know, my clients, it's an option for them with the breakfast, and it's an option for them as a quick post-workout. But for a carb source, I don't like to go to the processed carb source, and I would rather use something like ground rice flour or creamed rice flour.
Okay.
Now, that's not rice pudding. That is actual rice flour.
Okay.
Now, if you get the straight rice flour, it's a bit chalky when you mix it up, but basically all you're consuming is crushed rice.
Hmm. I've never used that before.
I prefer that because it's not a simple sugar. It's still a complex carb.
Yeah.
And then again, we go back to this managing insulin as well. You know, when you start using in carb drinks, and most of them are very fast acting, most of them are basically simple sugars. And as a result, we start to damage our insulin sensitivity.
Mm, okay.
So I like the key things. And if you're eating regularly during the day off season, I've never understood this one. Why do I need a carb intra workout? Because I've eaten carbs all day. Fuck me. If my glycogen stores aren't full, then there's something seriously wrong.
Yeah.
If you need carbs during your workout, before your workout, then there's something seriously wrong with your diet. Now, if you want to take liquid carbs within your workout because you're just trying to get the overall carb intake up, then fair enough. That's a different matter.
Okay.
If you're doing it because you want to fuel your workout, then there's something not right.
Hmm, interesting. Should,
off season, you should not need intra carbs to fuel the workout.
Okay, that makes sense.
Either you're training far too bloody long, or there's something not quite working right with your diet.
We're getting into this a lot of stuff about diet. You mentioned too, though, that training is a big factor. You said diet management and training are the two things that are going to make this work, make you able to grow the size we want to grow. What's the training you have to do with this now?
Well, everyone says that physiques are made in the kitchen, and I disagree. I think physiques are made in the gym.
Okay.
Because I think the most important factor of all this is training. And I've seen guys over the years that live off Mars bars and bottles of milk and just absolute garbage.
Yeah.
And they're not lean, but they build size because their training is intense.
Hmm.
But, and this is where I think a lot of people mess up. I think we've got two problems going on. I think we have a fear of training, and I'm not on about a fear of being uncomfortable or being in pain. I'm on about a fear of doing too much. And I think we have a massive inefficiency in training.
Hmm. What do you mean by that?
Well, I've seen guys go in the gym and they are busting their balls and they come out and they're dead and they're soaked wet through with sweat.
Okay.
But they've had very little targeted muscle activation.
Okay.
And the loads of stresses have gone through the skeletal frame, they've gone through the tendon, or they've been spread about over several muscle groups, which weren't the targeted muscle they were trying to hit.
I see. I feel like I had been guilty of this years ago. I would squat, and I would only feel it in my hips. I would kill myself in squats. I would work really hard, lift heavy weights, but it never was going into my quads where I wanted it.
No, and this is where, I mean, a real simple sort of way of describing this is when you bench press, and we're talking now for muscular activity, right? So we're not talking about power,
right,
or powerlifting or anything like this. It's purely for muscular activity. When we bench press, the muscle is our pectoral muscle, and the hinge point is our shoulder. The lever involved in the movement is our upper arm. Now, the point of load, if you want to maximize the stress on a hinge point, then you need to put the point of load at the end of the lever.
Okay.
So the ideal position for your hand, which is in contact with the load, to be is above your elbow all the time. Now, if you go wider, then what happens is you create a secondary hinge at the elbow, because now we've got a hinge from the elbow to the hand.
Yeah.
So part of the load that's going down the forearm to the elbow is deflected into the bicep.
Yeah.
If you bring the hand tighter in, we still create this hinge at the elbow, but now the downward force isn't just pushing down on that upper arm lever, it's also pushing down on the forearm and therefore activating the tricep. So people argue, well, I move more weight. But what you actually find is what happens is it minimizes the load that's on the bar from hitting the chest. Yeah. And most people that bench press, only about 40%. And if you don't think this is true, look at powerlifters. Any powerlifter will tell you they don't bench with the chest. They bench with the shoulders, the triceps, and the backs.
Interesting.
Now, when you break things down, and I've started doing quite a bit of training work with some powerlifters, and I took a guy whose shirted bench was, I think his best was about 200.
Okay. And you're talking kilos now.
Yeah, 200 kilos. And he's a 98 kilo lifter.
Okay.
He will bench 270 in May.
Okay.
He'll have a 70 kilo PB. Bear in mind, he's already a world champion at 200 kilo bench and a record holder, a British record holder. He broke two British records 2 weeks ago in one of his qualifiers.
And he moved up 70 pounds.
Kilos. He will put 70 kilos on his bench when he does the finals in May.
How and now what are you changing in him specifically?
We went back to basics and we broke his bench bench apart. And I stopped him training like a powerlifter, and I made him train, not particularly like a bodybuilder, but I made him train for maximum chest activation. And then we put it all back together, added the powerlifting back in, and the sum of the parts is greater.
Okay. So once again, he's using the back, he's using the triceps, the shoulders, and now the pecs.
Yeah. So we made every muscle involved in the lift work maximally, and then we put it all back together.
Interesting.
And this is... I'm a great one for efficiency in training. You see, our biggest expense, if you take away the chemicals, our biggest expense is food. So why would you fill your car with expensive petrol and then drive around in first gear? So why do you do that with your training? Yeah. If we're going to expend expenditure in the gym and then we're going to use proteins for recovery, yeah, then I want to make sure that energy I expend and those I use as efficiently as possible. So I want the maximum muscle stimulation for the movement that I do. So I work a lot on getting muscles to work correctly in the movement you're doing. And this means greatest range and complete muscular control and not relying on tendons or skeletal control. Now, there's no disputing that the deadlift is an incredible exercise. It's a brilliant exercise. But it wasn't designed to build big backs. It does build big backs, but it was designed to test our strength. Now, at the top of a deadlift, you will drive your hips through.
Okay.
So what muscle is holding that bar weight when you're stood up with it at the top of the deadlift?
It's not your back anymore.
And it's not really anything, is it? Because what you're trying to do is transfer as much of the load down through your skeletal frame as possible.
Okay.
So if you keep the hip back, don't let the hip come forward, your back has to hold the weight.
I see.
And it's things like that, maximizing the muscle movement within. And the biggest thing I find with people is you've just got to focus on what the end goal is a little bit more and not so much the journey. And what people do, they get too focused on the journey, so they're too concerned with what weight's on the bar or how many reps they do. Now, reps and weight are a useful measuring tool for progress.
Sure.
But I don't count any reps when I train. I just go completely off how I feel.
I remember you mentioning that last time we spoke.
So I focus on feeling what's working. I focus on absolutely destroying the muscle. And I'll train back, pretty big body part, and I'll come out of the gym and my back will feel like absolute jelly. But I actually won't feel that knackered. I'll know I've done a workout, but I won't be absolutely wiped out, where in my training in the past, I've had to go to bed for an hour because I'm absolutely destroyed.
How long ago were you able to make this switch?
It's been progressive.
Okay.
Certain body parts happened very early on. Other body parts I struggled with and it took time. I've had a lot of problems with my squat. And it's taken probably 18 years to fix my squat.
Wow.
Now, that was because of an injury. I was crushed, and it did a lot of damage. And the result of that was that my glutes didn't fire properly and my lower ab wall didn't work properly.
Okay.
And I never rehabbed it because I never realized. All I was interested in was moving the weight that was on the bar. And I still got up to repping with 300 kilo. But then I couldn't go any further. And I had a powerlifter look at my squat and they went, well, you're so quad dominant in the squat that the only muscles that actually working are your quads. Your glutes and your hams are doing next to bugger all. So it's taken, because these muscles have been so sort of dormant in that exercise for so long.
Yeah.
It's taken a lot of work and a lot of focus and a lot of time to actually get, and I've actually had to really sort of do a very strange squat.
Okay.
Where I sort of lean forward and stick my ass right out backwards.
Really?
To get it to start to engage properly in that movement. And then as it's got better and more controlled and sort of cotton on to that, learn that that's what it's supposed to do, I've been able to lift my body a bit more and bring my knees a little bit more forward. And so my squat for a while looked like a good morning gone wrong. But it's just been a very long process. And one of the things I do a lot with clients is we spend time in teaching the central nervous system to work correctly. And if you do a very slow rep, so if you do a TUT style rep, say 5 seconds up or 5 seconds down, and you find that through that movement, you're juddering in parts of the movement, that's because your central nervous system's not firing efficiently. So the muscle isn't firing smoothly. Now, once you get that smoothness throughout that movement, then that means that your central nervous system, the nerves are firing sequentially in order to engage the muscle through the movement correctly.
Okay.
Now, once you get that working properly, then you can start to generate more power.
Interesting. So I take it if somebody wants to work on this, the number one thing they're probably going to have to do is lighten the weight, find something that they can really control, and then start building the weight back up from there?
And slow it down.
Slow it down.
I mean, I use a hybrid. I developed a bit of, developed probably a bit of a cocky way of putting it, I suppose. But I played around and came up with a sort of workout program. There's a hybrid of some TUT work and then some heavy work. And I don't let any client start moving heavy weight until they get the TUT stuff working properly for them. And then when they're coming to me and saying, yeah, I'm feeling every single rep, I'm in pain all through the workout, DOMS are massive, huge pumps, then we turn around and go, right, now you go heavy and you're only allowed 12 sets for your chest.
Interesting.
And then that forces them to, so they've already got engagement. At this point, they've got really good muscular engagement through the movements they're doing. And then we drop the sets, and that forces them to gain intensity.
Okay.
Because they, for now, for the last 3 months, have been getting really good feel in their chest or their arms or their shoulders, whatever it is, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But they've been getting really good feedback, really good muscle engagement, really good pain. And you get addicted to that. And you'll know, you know, you do a set and you get that one rep where you feel that muscle just literally fires perfectly from start to finish. And the fear within the muscle is almost euphoric.
Yeah.
Well, you've got addicted to that by this point. And then it's like, right, I'm taking all this away. You've got 12 sets, three exercises, four sets exercise, and you've got to create the same sensation. So suddenly you become very efficient.
You don't mess around. You're not going to warm up on this set. You're going to get everything you can out of it is what you're saying.
Yeah, you become incredibly efficient then with your workout, and you become incredibly quick at engaging the muscle.
Yeah.
And then we start moving weight. But now the weight we're moving is going where we want it to go. It's not going in the skeletal frame. It's not going on the tendon. It's not going on another muscle. It's going on the target muscle. And I'm also a great believer in low volume but high frequency. And I know Jordan Peters is the same.
Yeah.
I mean, me and Jordan used to argue black and blue because he was a big advocate of DC. And I kept telling him there's better ways.
Okay.
DC is very effective, but it also has its downfalls. And he recommended to all his clients, and I'm saying it won't work for your clients, Jordan, because they're not you. Jordan's another world of dedication.
Yeah.
The dedication that lad has to what he does is phenomenal. If you could bottle that, you'd be a millionaire overnight.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Yeah, absolutely right.
You know, he's almost robotic in the way he dedicates himself to what he does.
Yeah.
But you say to someone, right, here you go, here's a set of exercises and a set of weight, here's a logbook, I want you to beat those weights every week.
Yeah.
What happens?
Just do two sets too, you know.
Yep. What happens if you're focused on beating the logbook every week?
Well, a guy like Jordan is going to beat it, he's going to continue to work harder, but what are you saying? You're saying that not everybody's going to be able to do that.
I'm saying your average person, their focus will go away from muscular engagement and start going towards numbers.
Okay.
If they're just reps and sets, they start to cheat.
I see.
Because the focus now is not about damaging muscle and muscle recruitment. The focus is now about weight, reps, and numbers. And I've got to beat my logbook. So if I go a little bit short on that last rep, or I twist a little bit, or I give it a little bit of a bounce to get it up, well, it doesn't matter because I beat my numbers.
Yeah.
Where Jordan has the discipline and focus to remain strict within the set, but the average person ain't going to do that. All they're going to be interested in is beating the numbers. And the next thing you know, they're injured, and then the whole shit goes out the window.
So you give people more sets than that, it sounds like. Did you mention 12 sets, say, on a given exercise?
No, 12 sets on a given body part.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, that's what I meant. Pardon me. So 12 sets on a given body part. And then how much frequency are you doing with that?
Twice a week.
Okay.
Which then comes into 24 sets. All right. I don't mind a couple of extra warm-ups, so maybe 26, 27 sets.
Okay.
And then you're sort of in the same rep volume as the high-volume guys, but you're using more weight because you're doing less reps and sets per workout. So the overall net is more weight moved over a period of time, therefore more growth.
Okay. Yeah, I see where you're going with that. So, you know, we've talked all about training. You know, one more thing about training. So rest, I think that's an important factor we didn't talk about yet. How much rest a week do you think is going to be beneficial? How does somebody know when they need rest? Let me ask it that way.
I think you need to listen to your body.
Okay.
Now, just because you feel like shit and tired doesn't mean you're too tired and you need rest. Sometimes you feel like that. You go to the gym, you have the best workout ever. So my old set rule is that if you get 2-3 workouts in a row that aren't productive, are under par, or you're struggling with, then chances are you possibly need a bit of downtime, but you look at everything in balance. So it's like, well, I haven't trained for a couple of days. I've had 3 pretty sure workouts on the bounce. Well, it doesn't even my rest that's an issue. So maybe I'm coming down with a bug, or maybe my sleep's not being brilliant. There's something else that's causing that problem. if you've been hitting the gym three on, one off for the last 3 months, and all of a sudden everything starts to go a bit shitty, then take 3-4 days off.
Okay.
Take 3-4 days off and then go back at it. But give it a couple of workouts before you make that decision. Don't just react to the first workout that's crap. So once you're consistently seeing a slightly negative trend, then I'd take a little bit more time off, building a couple of extra days.
Okay.
And I find this the same with diet. You know, all my clients, they don't have preset macros. We work off how they feel with their appetites. And then we get to a point where they're generally comfortable all the time with the food. Then we'll switch to condition and weight. So I don't pretend, I start everybody in a slight deficit, and we build into what they, how their body reacts.
I heard you mention that on Vicky Mercedes podcast. I love that idea. So what's the general idea, the reasoning behind starting somebody in a deficit and then building up?
Well, there's two things. I mean, the first thing I do with everybody is I start to look at improving their insulin sensitivity. So we have a period of keto or low carb. It's not really keto. It's more of a day of the lumbo keto because protein's too high and fats are high enough. But basically what we're looking to do is create some sensitivity.
Okay.
Then when we reintroduce carbs, we introduce them quite low because we don't want to overload the situation we've created. And we've also created a little bit of a mini rebound. And then we just slowly build that up. Your body does not react well to big changes and fast changes. You know, sometimes you can use that overcompensation of the body as in a positive. And what that's the theory behind sodium and water loading pre-comp is that you do a rapid change, which causes an adverse effect within the body, an adverse reaction, but we use that to our advantage. So when it comes to diet, you see, I completely disagree with this bulk cut. You should cut them bulk. Because it takes quite a period of time for your body to accept changes as being permanent. So at the end of a bulk, we want to hold mass.
Yeah.
But at the end of a cut, we want to regain mass. So if we use a cut before a bulk, then we use the body's natural rebound to our advantage.
I like that.
But if you use a cut at the end of a bulk, then actually that natural rebound, which happens in the opposite direction as well, because your body's going to want to come down because it's not liking the extra weight you've put on.
Sure.
Works as a disadvantage to us because then we start sacrificing muscle mass. So at the end of a bulk, you really need a couple of months of maintenance.
That makes sense.
Everybody's the way around. It's the same with drugs. Why do people increase their drug taking going into a competition when they're in a calorie deficit?
Why do they increase it as they're going into a calorie deficit to preserve muscle? Would be my answer.
Are you telling me that 1 gram of gear a week is going to preserve more than 1/2 gram of gear a week?
Yeah, that one I don't know about. But you can get a different effect, say, adding Winstrol, you know, for instance, for the last 4 weeks.
Because of how it affects hormone balance with progesterone and estrogen and therefore water retention and that sort of thing. Yeah, but you're not growing.
No, God, no.
So why are you ramming so much gear through your system at a point when your body is vulnerable and you look rough and you feel like shit? Why would you start adding high doses of Tren to make you feel shitter unless you're trying to compensate for something of a problem?
Okay.
Now, there are times when basically upping the dose or upping the Tren, as everybody likes to say, will compensate for some issues you might have with softness and things like that. But in general, I mean, I don't do a lot of comp prep because I can't be arsed with clients messaging me 33 times a day because they've eaten one too many asparagus leaves that morning.
Right, right.
But I do it occasionally, and I am doing it with a guy at the moment, and he's the leanest and biggest he's ever been, and yet he's on the lowest amount of drugs he's ever been. But the other thing is his blood work is spot on, and he feels, apart from tired and hungry, well.
That's awesome.
And yet, usually when we up the dose or we introduce drugs, we are compensating for the fact that we've not got something quite right.
I see where you're going with this now.
So I've never understood that, you know, all right, well, I bulked on a gram of gear a month and, a gram of gear a week. And yeah, fair enough, all right, off season, because you can eat a lot more food. Maybe you don't need as much gear.
Yeah.
But I'm going into comp now and I'm going up to 2.5, 3. And it's like, whoa, hang on a minute. I understand taking a little bit more for muscle preparation, but what I don't understand is taking 3 times as much more.
Yeah.
And then when something goes wrong, and they can't, the thing is, why is it that natural bodybuilders hit the stage consistently with condition and dryness and fullness, show in, show out, show in, show out, but drug users can never get it right?
That's a good question. They're obviously not relying on the right tools.
So, you know, it's the drugs, and it's to me, it's just too much. You're using too much, back it off a little bit.
Yeah.
Get the basics right. And this is the other thing. When I take a client on, I don't care if they're on cycle, mid-cycle, what they're doing, they're either going on to a proper cruise.
Okay.
250 meg every 14 days. Or they're coming off.
Huh.
Because I need to get the diet and training working right for you. I can't do that if drugs are in there.
Amen. I hear you.
So once we get the training and diet working right, Jesus Christ, I could throw Smarties at you and you're going to grow.
Yeah, then you can optimize.
And so I've got a bit of a reputation for getting people big and being quite successful at that. And that is because we get the basics right first.
You've got the foundations.
A lot of people come to me expecting this incredible drug secret protocol.
Mm.
And when they suddenly find out that they're having to do a diet to start with and they're having to go really light with the weights and go back to basics, this is not where I want, I'll see you later.
Hmm.
But the guys that dedicate themselves to it and get their heads down are the guys that see incredible results.
Interesting.
And, you know, everyone goes, oh, you can't gain 20 pounds in 6 months of muscle. Yes, you fucking can. If you're willing to do what needs to be done and you're willing to hurt, yes, you can.
Hmm.
And I've got plenty of clients that have put 30, 35, 40 pound on in a cycle, 12 weeks, 14 weeks. Granted, it's not all muscle, but when the dust has settled, they're still sitting 12, 15, 16 pound heavier than they were when they started.
Which is a ton.
With equal condition. Yes. Now, you're not going to do that repetitively because obviously the closer you get to the top, the harder it is to gain.
Sure.
But if you can take a world champion and put 70 kilo on his bench, he's telling you something about the fact that people just overcomplicate shit.
Hmm.
And people don't listen to themselves.
Hmm.
One thing that drives me insane is this overcomplication that people have with things. Well, I need to count my steps and I need to do this and I need to do that.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, just eat to what your body requires. Listen to what it's doing. I understand with contest prep that if you have a very physical job and for whatever reason you're not doing that job for a couple of weeks, that will have to be very much factored into your dieting.
Sure.
Because you're going to have a massive drop in energy expenditure. But off season, it's like, oh, I need to hit 10,000 steps a day. Why?
Yeah.
Well, I need to be consistent. Why? Because there's nothing consistent about the way our body works. Hmm. Our body is designed to deal and cope with fluctuations.
Hmm.
And the whole way our system works is actually to cope with fluctuations. It's not designed to cope with everything being perfectly static. In fact, if you keep your hormone levels in your blood's 2 level,
yeah,
you'll actually cause your body to start clearing that hormone out faster than it normally would, which will effectively lower the dose that's in your blood.
Hmm.
And this is why you start seeing a lot of guys on cycle 6-8 weeks in going, I've just done my bloods and my test level's nowhere near as high as where it should be for the gear I'm on. The gear must be bunk. No, it's not bunk. It's because you're injecting it too frequently and your body's starting to clear it out faster.
Hmm.
And when you look at the levels they've got against their expected levels, you'll find that they're roughly about half. Now, okay. scientifically, it's known as terminal half-life.
Yeah.
When blood stability occurs in the human body with a chemical or a hormone, the body will upregulate the clearance of that hormone.
Hmm. Interesting. I hadn't thought about that.
So, you know, I think people overcomplicate it. I really do. And it's like, I think people are way too anal over macros. You know, oh, I must hit 220 grams of carbs a day.
Yeah.
Well, to be honest, it doesn't matter if you hit 200 today and 240 tomorrow and 250 the day after. And as long as you're there or thereabouts.
Yeah.
It's the consistency that you're up in that region day in, day out that makes the difference.
Yeah, for sure.
And so it's you know, don't get me wrong. If you're supposed to hit 240 and you hit 220 every day, then obviously you're not going to grow because you're low.
Right.
But if you have the odd day low, as long as the net amount over a week or so is in excess, then you're going to start to grow.
Sure. I follow you. Everybody's keeping things too complicated. Sounds like you're saying, you know, training being a key element, people need to focus more on that, more on getting the muscle to work, focusing on that first, the foundations, the diet. Yeah, everything you're talking about, Dave, I think is going back to foundations because in the diet too, it's foundations. It's getting back to good insulin sensitivity before you can do anything. I like this. It's a basic approach is what I would call it. It's not a simple approach. You've got all your thoughts, you know, really well planned out here, but it's definitely taking everything back to making it simple and building from there.
You speak to any 80s or 90s bodybuilder, and there were no shortage of frigging mass monsters walking around then. Jean-Pierre Fox, Ian Harrison, Nasser El Sombati.
Yeah.
You know, they were all big guys. They carried just as much muscle mass as the big guys do now. And you start talking to them about how they trained and how they ate, and you'll find that they didn't track a macro. They didn't count a calorie. They trained very hard, very intensely, and they watched what their bodies did and adjusted accordingly. And they always made sure they had high-level, good-quality protein going in there.
Well, Dave,
and generally the drug usage was lower as well. There was always exceptions, but in general, the usage was lower.
We didn't even really get into to drug use here, which I think some people will be surprised by if they've been fans of the Under Construction films, because that was a big focus. But I like this. I think that this is the foundation. If people wanted to reach out to you, what's the best way for them to get a hold of you?
Well, they can email me, dave@crosslands, which is crosslands.org.uk. They can catch me on Facebook under Dave Crossland. If they're going to message me on Facebook, they better message me on my personal page and not so much on the athlete page or whatever it is. I don't really use that much these days, to be fair.
Okay.
But yeah, those are probably the two easiest ways.
Okay, awesome. And what's up for you? What are you planning? What are you doing with your bodybuilding at this point?
I'm getting fat and eating cake. Or should I say I'm getting fatter. I am slowly bringing my weight down, and that's purely health-based. I am getting back into training, but I'm more focused on training hard than I am on actually whatever weight I lift.
Yeah.
Drug use is gone completely now, 2.5 years.
Really?
Yep. Though I do think I'm probably going to have to jump on TRT. I'm starting to just feel life a little bit harder than it really should be. So I'm going to get some testing done shortly, and I think it's going to be a case I'm going to need TRT, which, you know, is no surprise considering what I've done in the past.
Sure, sure.
But just for my kidney health, I need to be smaller.
That makes sense, man. We want to keep you around.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, you're one of few. And, you know, obviously the first area I need to get rid of is fat, because that's something I've got plenty of. So you will probably sometime over the next 4 or 5 months see a smaller, leaner version of me.
You feel? Do you feel okay with that? Because you're such a big guy. Do you feel that you're okay with the losing it?
It's taken some adjustment, yeah. And I still have days where it frustrates me. I mean, a daft thing was, and it's so stupid. I did a talk on drug abuse and mental health.
Yeah.
And what causes what sort of thing. And the event wanted me to wear a T-shirt, and they said, what size are you? And I went 5XL. Oh, we've only got a 4. I took it. I never put it on. I put it on the other day, and it fit me like a 5 did. And that's stupid, I know. But there was a little pan of pain there, and it was like, fuck.
I hear you. I think we all can feel that one.
You know? And I suppose, I mean, the whole... There was a little bit of a conscious change. You know, I was first known for being big, sometimes negatively, sometimes positively.
Yeah.
And I was known for pushing it a little bit when it came to the drugs. I mean, there's those that have gone before me that have taken more, and there are those that are still around now that take more.
Yeah.
4.5 gram, if people are actually honest about their drug use, is probably not as excessive as people like to make it out to be.
Sure.
It is excessive, but it's probably more commonplace than people actually would like to admit.
Yeah.
But I've worked hard to, since then, change what I'm known for.
Okay, yeah, I see what you mean.
And I would like to think that though I'm still known for that, I'm also known now for my harm reduction work and my knowledge on the chemicals. And I'd like to think that I'm now starting to get known of having some knowledge on training as well.
Yeah,
and part of the process of that, of that reinventation of who I am, is to a degree replace the identity of well, that's Big Dave.
Mm.
I mean, I'm quite at one with myself, and I'm quite comfortable in who I am as a person. But yeah, you know, there has been, I suppose you can't really say any more than a period of mourning.
Yeah,
for the fact that I will no longer, and retrospectively, you know, if you want to look at it from a point of view of in the context of the films, you see one, it should have stopped there.
Mm.
Because at 365, I was strong, I could move, I for my size and weight, I was reasonably athletic. I wasn't athletic in any way, shape or form compared to an athlete, but I could walk up a flight of stairs.
Yeah.
And going beyond that was just a step too far. There's no two ways about that. The result of UC2 was an unhealthy, very ill, fat mess.
Yeah. It was hard to watch, man. It was hard to watch.
But I do think the strange thing is I got a lot of criticism over the first film, and I didn't get much to me criticism over the second film.
Really?
And I don't know if that was because people knew what I was about when it came to the second film. Or if just people actually recognize the openness of the second film.
Mm, okay.
I've watched the second film once, and I don't like it, and I don't want to watch it again.
Yeah. I could see that from your perspective. I could see it.
Because if I filmed one of the periods of your life where there was nothing particularly positive about it in the context of that film that I filmed of your life, and then said, there you go, you can watch one of your biggest mistakes in HD, crack on.
Whew, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I could see that.
It was the unscratchable itch that I wanted to itch, and I did that. And I do miss the 350, 360 pound me and the power I had at the time, I don't miss the 400 and 450 pound me in any shape or form.
Yeah.
Because I have my life back.
Yeah,
and I don't think people actually sometimes comprehend how all-consuming being that big is.
Yeah,
because you can't do anything because you have to bloody eat.
Hmm.
You don't maintain that sort of size without food, and you need a lot of it. And it's expensive, but it's also very time-consuming.
Yeah.
And you can't suddenly turn around and go, you know what, it's a sunny day, let's go in car, let's go for a drive, because it's like, shit, hang on, I've got to make 6 meals before we can go.
Yeah.
So it's nice to have that flexibility, and it's nice to have that sort of life back. But I find the harm reduction stuff incredibly rewarding.
I'm sure, man. You get to help other people. And I think, too, that, you know, as hard as under construction, too, might be for you to look at, I think it could be beneficial to other people, too. And they could, maybe they won't have to scratch the itch after having
seen
it.
I think if anything else, at least it was an honest representation of what can happen.
Yeah.
And I think the industry is full of mass monsters, but none of those mass monsters are honest about what being that size actually does to them. In how they feel and how uncomfortable it is and how difficult it is to exist when you are mega big.
I feel like we could do a whole show on this topic, Dave, especially as you progress, as you downsize. I would love to talk to you more about this, bring you back and do a whole episode about the physical and the psychological sides of reducing.
Yeah, the psychological sides are intriguing, and you have to have the ability of being very honest with yourself. And I mean, I wouldn't say big celebrities within our industry because I don't really know any of those sort of people. I've got a few mates that, you know, I'm friends with Ian Harrison. I know him from when he was 18, 19. He came to the gym I worked at when I was 16 and absolutely destroyed me. I was just like, what the hell is that? How can he be 3 years older than me and look like that?
Yeah.
It just blew my mind. He was a monster. I see personalities online and I know a little bit more about what's going on in their lives than they probably would want the public to. And I find it, I mean, I don't want to, and I never would stand there and publicize or talk about someone's personal life. It's not my style. I don't do throwing shit about.
Sure.
I don't mind calling someone out for being a dick, but I'm not going to talk ill of people that I don't feel it's necessary. But at the same time, it frustrates me when they're online jumping up and down about how great this is or how great that is. And I'm just thinking, I know it's not. And I just think, you know what, if we were all a little bit more honest about the fuck-ups in our lives, then we'd all benefit from that. Because if we all showed the other side of the coin and that this isn't all roses and big weight and feeling fucking wonderful, and that, you know, I am scared of coming off or and I'm not talking about me personally here, but, you know, as a person that's a public figure, yeah, I am scared of coming off and I am scared of losing my sight, then people would realize that that's a lot more common than they think.
Yeah.
When I did this mental health talk, one of the things I talked about was that what we do is not normal.
Sure.
And to any normal person, we probably all have mental health issues. And we normalize what we do within our community, but actually it isn't normal. And that doesn't mean you shouldn't do it or anything like that, but it means you should really step out of the box and look at it from somebody who doesn't train. And I'm not talking, because we always say, oh, well, yeah, but they drink. I'm not talking about people that are unhealthy. I'm talking about people that are fit, unhealthy, that are healthy, have balanced, healthy lifestyles.
Yeah.
They still look at us like we're a bunch of weirdos.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And that we're not. And that's because we are.
That's right.
Be a negative thing, but the truth is we are.
Sure. To try to be 400 pounds.
You look at a plate of food and your brain goes, well, that's roughly 30 grams of carbs, 20 grams of protein, and 10 grams of fat. Whoa, that ain't normal, mate. You've got an unhealthy relationship with food if you kind of like your meals like that, and that's the first thing that comes into your head.
And just because all your friends also do the same thing doesn't make it normal.
It's cheat day, so I can consume 2,500 calories of absolute shit in one day.
Right.
And eat to the point where I feel like I'm going to explode and actually feel incredibly ill and fall asleep in a carb coma. That ain't a normal relationship with food either.
Yeah.
And it's the same with the drug relationship. We normalize things. But there's all these people out there that I know are, I think steroid dependency is a lot more common than people are willing to accept.
Sure. I think that ties in a lot to not wanting to shrink down too. I think that, I was just talking about this on another show yesterday. If you have health issues, the smart thing to do would be to come off the gear. But if your sense of self is tied to being big and it takes that gear to keep you big, then I think that's where some people start making the mistakes and they start compromising and they say, well,
you know, I know people that have gone through severe health problems. And I know that throughout their severe health problems, they were still using. And it boggles the mind sometimes. I mean, I felt so shit when my kidneys started to fail and everything else that it was incredibly easy for me to come off at that point.
Yeah.
And then by the time I'd sort of come round a little bit, so to speak, several months later, it was like, well, you know, it's done now. I've got no choice.
Yeah.
But there are still days. I still have gear in the house because it's in nature of what I do for a job anyway. And I'd be a liar if I said I hadn't opened the drawer and looked at it a couple of times. Because I have.
Yeah.
But I've got enough to know, you know, that isn't me. I don't need that. And I think if there's anything in your life that you get to a point where it's not a desire to do, it's a need to do, then you've got to question your relationship with it.
Yeah.
So if you're not training for a specific event, i.e. a comp, and you can't take a day off to attend a family event, you can't eat a cream cake or an ice cream when you're at the seaside with the kids or when you're attending a family function or a wedding and stuff like that, then you've got to question a little bit about your relationship with what you do. Because one ice cream is not going to destroy your physique. Now, right. If you're competing and you're dieting for a show, completely different ball game.
Right.
But when you're not competing, one ice cream is not going to destroy it. But if you refuse to do that, you refuse that time. And people say, oh, well, it's not my choice. It's not my choice. I just choose not to do it. No, you don't choose not to do it. You can't do it. You won't allow yourself to do it because you're too scared of the consequences. Then you've got to start questioning your relationship. And, you know, the fitness industry breeds mental health issues. Whether it attracts mental health issues, I'm not too sure if it's that, but it definitely has huge mental health issues within it.
Yeah.
But the thing is, people just won't be honest because they're too scared within our industry, within our environment, to show a weakness. Because it's all about being big and macho and strong and massive and all that bullshit.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know what? There's nothing wrong with being human. But I see key figures all the time. And I mean, I don't want to talk ill of the dead, and I like Rich. I thought he was a cracking guy. I met him a couple of times and we got on really well. And he was a genuinely nice fella. But Rich was fucked in the head. And that was driven. He was so insecure about, you know, the way he appeared. And that drove him to do things that ultimately cost him his life. And we hide it all. And when's the last time you do get it a bit more now, but when we see low-end amateurs complain about having side effects and problems on cycle.
Yeah.
So you're telling me that every pro and every high-end amateur who has a high following on Instagram or Facebook or Snapchat or whatever the fuck doesn't have drug-related issues. All their cycles are brand new.
Right.
Bullshit. But they don't talk about it. But why not? It's not negative. In fact, it's a great opportunity to educate people and you know?
Yeah.
The mental health thing, the amount of people that messaged me after that talk and said, you know what, Dave, I am actually scared to come off.
Yeah.
Or I'm anxious about coming off, or I'm worried about coming off. And it shouldn't be like that. But then that boils down to a lot of the fact that people just don't have the knowledge when it comes to training. Everybody researches drugs. Everybody researches diet. Diet has probably got to be one of the most researched topics there is, followed by drugs.
Yeah.
When's the last time you spoke to someone that was researching training?
It's left out, that's for sure.
But it's the primary start of everything we do.
Yeah. I think it seems like people feel like they already get it. Like they get the training. I know how to do a dumbbell curl.
Do you?
All right. You know what I mean?
I guarantee you now. Right, I'm gonna say three things to do with a dumbbell curl. One of the probably most simple exercises there are because it's single lever.
Yeah.
Well, it's not actually, there's two levers. Because the second lever is the wrist.
Okay.
So, first thing, you pin the elbow, and you pin the elbow forward of 90 degrees to the body. So when you sit on a bench, you want to make sure it's a 90-degree bench, and then you just move your elbow an inch forward.
An inch forward from
directly being down.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. Second thing, lift your chest.
Yep.
Never drop your chest in any movement. Always keep your chest lifted. Always keep your posture high.
I'm actually following along with you right now doing this.
Next thing, push the dumbbell as far back into your palm as you can. Most of us dumbbell curl with a dumbbell around the sort of in between the bend of the first knuckle and the second knuckle. So the dumbbell sits bottom edge of the palm where the fingers start.
Yeah.
Move it back. Move it behind the first knuckle. So if you stand now and you bend, keep all your fingers straight, but bend at the first knuckle.
Yep.
You'll see a natural groove there, a natural gap between your thumb and the first knuckle, which is just about bar thickness.
Yeah.
Put the bar there, then wrap round. Second thing, grip with your little finger.
Huh. You're saying start from the outside in on your hand. Start from the pinky in.
And always keep the palm facing forward if you are curling. So if you're doing a dumbbell curl, seated dumbbell curl, you're sat on the bench is at 90 degrees, you've got your ass right back in the bench, your chest is lifted, your elbow is slightly forward of your center line, your grip is as described. When you start the movement, you start from a tense tricep and your palm is facing forward.
I feel that tense tricep when I'm in that position too.
And then as you pull, and bearing in mind that your elbow doesn't move, so your hand should create a large arc.
Yeah.
That's one thing a lot of people do is let the elbow drift forward so that the hand actually creates more of a flat line.
Yeah.
And then as you come to the top, you don't come up and then tense the bicep. You just keep pulling and pulling and pulling that palm up into your shoulder.
Interesting.
So if you do that now as a movement, just with nothing in your hand, open your palm, completely relax your hand, and just contract your bicep and just pull and pull and pull and keep pulling in. As opposed to the top and then tensing, keep pulling through.
I feel it differently. I do. I like that.
There's so much you can do to exercises.
Yeah.
So much if you just take the time to slow the movement down and play around with them.
And that's something that you just explained simply just in 1 minute over the radio. I mean, I see where you're coming from there. You know, there is a lot of information about diet. There's a hell of a lot of information out there about drugs. I do though. I feel like people think that they know how to train, you know, they've lifted weights. They know how to do it. They don't ask.
There's a difference between the nirvana of training would be to be able to just literally contract a muscle and move weight.
Hmm.
So if it was a bench press, you'd hold the bench press, you'd lower it to your chest, and then all you'd do is focus on just flexing the pec. And that would cause contraction, which would cause the arms to lift. I mean, I'm dead against push-pull. And this sounds a bit weird, but because every muscle pulls, no muscle pushes. And just the thought process behind a pushing movement completely changes how you think about muscular activation. New bench press, you don't push a bar, you pull an arm. And just changing that way you approach movements and thought processes about movements changes how your brain links in with that muscle.
I like that. We're out of time here, though. We went way over, which is great, man. We went way over. We ended up going off in a bunch of really interesting directions I wouldn't have ever thought of. Can you remind everybody once again how they can get a hold of you, what your email is?
Yeah, certainly. My email is Dave, D-A-V-E, at Crosslands, which is crosslands.org.uk.
Awesome. Dave, I really appreciate you taking the time, man. I know you're a busy guy. You've got a lot going on. So thank you for coming on to share your thoughts and helping to educate people, because it really means a lot to me personally, and I know that it'll mean a lot to the audience.
My pleasure.
Guys, for Advices Radio, I'm Scott McNally with Dave Crossland.
Advices Radio Network.